The Bible reading is from Genesis chapter 18, and you can find it on page 17 of the Church Bibles. Genesis chapter 18. The Lord appeared to Abraham near the great trees of Mamre while he was sitting at the entrance to his tent in the heat of the day. Abraham looked up and saw three men standing nearby. When he saw them, he hurried from the entrance of his tent to meet them and bowed low to the ground. He said, "If I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, do not pass your servant by. Let a little water be brought, and then you may all wash your feet and rest under this tree. Let me get you something to eat so you can be refreshed and then go on your way, now that you have come to your servant." "Very well," they answered. "Do as you say." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah. "Quick," he said, "get three seahs of the finest flour and knead it and bake some bread." Then he ran to the herd and selected a choice tender calf and gave it to a servant who hurried to prepare it. He then brought some curds and milk and the calf that had been prepared and set these before them. While they ate, he stood near them under a tree. "Where is your wife, Sarah?" they asked him. "There, in the tent," he said. Then the Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, will have a son." Now Sarah was listening at the entrance to the tent, which was behind him. Abraham and Sarah were already very old, and Sarah was past the age of childbearing. So Sarah laughed to herself as she thought, "After I am worn out and my Lord is old, will I now have this pleasure?" Then the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Will I really have a child now that I am old?' Is anything too hard for the Lord? I will return to you at the appointed time next year, and Sarah will have a son." Sarah was afraid, so she lied and said, "I did not laugh." But he said, "Yes, you did laugh." When the men got up to leave, they looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham walked along with them to see them on their way. Then the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him." Then the Lord said, "The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great, and their sin so grievous, that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know." The men turned away and went towards Sodom, but Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Then Abraham approached him and said, "Will you sweep away the righteous with the wicked? What if there are 50 righteous people in the city? Will you really sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous people in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to kill the righteous with the wicked, treating the righteous and the wicked alike. Far be it from you. Will not the judge of all the earth do right?" The Lord said, "If I find 50 righteous people in the city of Sodom, I will spare the whole place for their sake." Then Abraham spoke up again, "Now that I've been so bold as to speak to the Lord, though I am nothing but dust and ashes, what if the number of the righteous is 5 less than 50? Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5 people?" "If I find 45 there," he said, "I will not destroy it." Once again, he spoke to him, "What if only 40 are found there?" He said, "For the sake of 40, I will not do it." Then he said, "May the Lord not be angry, but let me speak. What if only 30 can be found there?" He answered, "I will not do it if I find 30 there." Abraham said, Now that I have been so bold as to speak to the Lord, what if only 20 can be found there?" He said, "For the sake of 20, I will not destroy it." Then he said, "May the Lord not be angry, but let me speak just once more. What if only 10 can be found there?" He answered, "For the sake of 10, I will not destroy it." When the Lord had finished speaking with Abraham, he left, and Abraham returned home. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God.
Thank you, Sarah. Good morning. The series we've been looking at focuses on spiritual disciplines, upon the behaviors and practices that we take up in our lives, which help us to live well as Christians. And the chapter appointed for this morning is about prayer. Some of that work is very practical and focused. It's about choosing a time and going into a space and closing the door and focusing on the work of prayer. Some very practical advice in the book. This morning I want to take a slightly different angle and look at some of the core values that lie behind a particular way of praying for other people, and to focus on some of the lessons that come from this chapter, Genesis 18, and see what we can learn about how prayer works. But I would encourage you to have a look at the chapter, to particularly if you would feel like you would benefit from some of the how lessons there that would be found there. So here we are with Genesis 18 and the story of Abraham, and particularly some lessons about how we pray for other people. The fancy word that gets used in churches a lot for that is intercession, praying for other people. And this chapter opens with this elderly couple. I've just spoken to the 9 o'clock congregation and was asking there if anybody around, you know, a little bit closer than I am to the age of 90, what it would feel like to get this bit of news. News to Sarah, you know, 90, and sudden announcement of unexpected pregnancy. Well, I think at any age, the news of unexpected pregnancy causes people to stop and think a little bit. It's a bit like those moments, they happen all the time, don't they, when you think you've got the future sketched out, the blackboard's well drawn, and circumstances, God himself, situations, other people come along with a board rubber. You can tell I grew up before computers, didn't you? Thinking board rubbers and chalk and stuff. And they come along with a board rubber and they wipe the board clean, and suddenly your plans for the future are just dust. Ever been there? And it makes you think a bit, doesn't it? It makes you stop and draw breath, and it makes you bewildered and preoccupied. And 90-year-old Sarah could have been forgiven to have booked herself an appointment at St. Francis Hospital, couldn't she? For a psychiatric assessment. What's going on? She could have been forgiven easily. Not that you need forgiveness for it. It's a great thing to do. But she could have been expected to be found up on the balcony, lift permitting, to go for some prayer. She could have been expected to be utterly bewildered and preoccupied, thinking every moment, talking every moment, what is happening in my life? What is going on? And into this situation, right in the middle of this preoccupation, God gives Abraham a cure. And the cure is, in some ways, quite unexpected. It's not to go for prayer ministry, good though that would be. It's not to go for counseling, good though that would be. Abraham's cure is to care, to focus on somebody else. Instead of facing his crisis of imminent birth, to focus on the crisis of the city, the imminent death and destruction that they're facing. Doesn't it get things in proportion a little bit? And isn't it sometimes a wonderful healing for us to get the spotlight off ourselves and onto others? Isn't it a wonderful thing sometimes? It's a hard thing sometimes when we want to be so preoccupied with our own circumstances. It's a challenging thing, but it's a thing that sometimes we find that God calls us into. And we have a pattern. We have an example. We have a model. Do you remember Jesus on the cross? If ever a person could be forgiven for focusing on themselves, it was in that moment, wasn't it? In an agony of rejection and physical pain. And yet we hear Jesus saying to his friend, "Behold your mother." To his mum, "Here's your son." Focusing on others, paying attention to their needs, looking beyond his own distress. Intercession, praying for others, keeps company with this kind of love. The discipline of praying for others leads us away from the vanity mirror to focus on other people. So here is Abraham and Sarah. Abraham trying to process this situation. Sarah realizing that it's the last time for her that she will be not given daffodils that Mothering Sunday. What an amazing moment. What an amazing shock to the system. And yet here's the call to focus on the city and pray for the city. Of course, Abraham had been preoccupied with the city for a good long time. If you read back in Genesis 14, the city is attacked, it's been raided. Many of the people are carried away to become slaves. Many of the possessions, the wealth of the city, has been captured. And Abraham saddles up, arms his entourage, and goes out and recaptures the people, recovers their possessions, rescues the people. And back in the city, the chief executive of that local authority offers to Abraham a sizable reward, but he won't take a penny. He's become the town's benefactor. And now, in this moment that we read about in Genesis 18, he is in this position of having an opportunity of rescuing the town again, this time through his prayers. There's no indication, of course, that he prayed for anywhere else. You don't see him in the scriptures praying for the city of Gomorrah. He's not praying for Ilkeston. He's not praying for other places. He's praying for the place which God has given to him. He's praying for the topic, the focus of his concerns. I don't know what it's like with you when you feel like you should pray for the needs of the world. Do you sometimes feel overwhelmed? Oh, it's just me, is it? You know, you turn on the news, and before you know where you are, you realize you should be praying for moral scandals and war and drugs and recession and starvation and global warming and injustice and inequality. And isn't it like that sometimes? It's just too much. So let's steal a lesson from Mastermind. A general studies round and a specialist subject. What's your specialist subject for prayer? What is the topic that God has given to you, has focused your attention on, the one area that you need to pray and pray and pray. Sunday by Sunday in our intercessions, we pray the general knowledge round, don't we? In a way, covering everything. And that's good. And we should do some of that. But there's something about our prayer for others, which is sometimes about what is your specialist subject? What is your focus? And maybe we release each other into that. So I'm not forcing you to take up my topic. It's okay. You do yours. And what a relief. It means I don't have to. I've just got to do mine. What's yours? Together, we can pray for everything. We're called in this church to pray for this city. Believers in Ilkeston will pray for Ilkeston. We pray for Nottingham. That way, it all gets done. Maybe we pray for other things too. But it's this prayer of persistence that is our call. To take the focus off ourselves, to focus on others, and to choose a focus, and to stay with that. Secondly, Abraham prayed with passion rather than precision. He heard the judgment of God, that this city was full of evil. And he didn't start his prayer by going, "Oh, that's a bit harsh." He accepted the judgment of God. He knows what people in the city are like. He knows that God has standards. He's into performance management. Performance matters. How we live makes a difference. And so Abraham accepts that reality and begins this negotiation of prayer with, in fact, a pretty low offer. What if 50 people, righteous people, are found in the city? Will that be acceptable? Will you save the city if there's 50 righteous people? He knows that violence and exploitation has become commonplace and it cannot be overlooked. He prays with hope. The Lord of all hopefulness demands that we find that handful of righteous people. It demands that we look to even the most sin-soaked individual. And we look for the surviving signs of grace, even in our enemies, even in those who are caught up in wickedness. If you're not sure about that, read Primo Levi, survivor of Auschwitz, and how he writes about the prison guards. Looking for the signs of grace, even in the neediest place. This is prayer. God's holiness demands that we recognize the sinfulness in our heroes and the weaknesses. Get this right, the other way around. I'm suddenly bewildered. And the blessing, the sign of grace in those who are most evil. Am I making sense? You see where I'm coming from? It's seeing it all. It's the honesty, the integrity, the wholeness of that picture. As we pray for violent people in our own city, we begin to care about their loneliness, their empty hearts. In prayer, we discover the best in bad people and acknowledge the worst in good people. This is the reality of prayer, the grim reality of sin meeting the love of God right there at the foot of the cross of Calvary. This is the place of prayer. So intercession puts the spotlight on other people, real people, and their real needs. Intercession, which is all sloppy sentimentality on the one hand, or all kind of angry fighting words on the other, has missed the Calvary road. But what do we actually ask for when we pray? How do we find the right words to pray? I'm really comforted by this chapter. There's Abraham praying for the nature of this city. He's praying for the, you know, how many righteous people. He's been looking at this city. He's been caring about this city. He's been the benefactor of the city for years. And so he knows the good and the bad. What if 50 righteous people? He is way out in his understanding, isn't he? Even as he starts his prayer, he's so wrong in his sociological analysis of the morality of the urban environment. So out of touch with what's really happening. And yet, being out by a factor of 10 does not stop his prayer. Because he's praying with passion, with love. It's only as we pray that way. I sometimes think that God kind of turns the volume down on the detail of our prayers and pays attention to the heart's cry, to the love, to the longing. So I want to tell you, folks, if you want to pray about what's going on in the legal system, you don't need to have to know as much as John Buckley. Can't see you, John. And even you don't know how to pray half the time. And I want to tell you that if you're praying for your kids, you don't have to be such a wonderful mum and dad as Andy and Sarah are. You don't have to know it all. If you're praying into the needs of our community, if you're praying into the arts community and how it demonstrates hope and vitality, you don't need to know as much as Steve and Janet. If you're praying for the needs of lonely, elderly people in this city, you don't need to care and understand, you don't need to know as much as Bill Phipps does about how they live their lives. You simply need to love. Being profoundly ignorant is a great place to start your prayer. Am I making sense? If you're baffled, if you're lost, if you don't know what to say, if you don't know how to speak, it's fine. Because God is listening to our love as we pray. That's what he hears. Sometimes I think of one of those Heath Robinson machines and our prayers go in one end. And all that clever words, all those understandings and rationale and logic and political awareness gets stripped away. And what comes out the other end is our love. Adam prayed with little precision and with lots of passion. Won't that do? Isn't that how it is? So you don't need a degree in politics to pray. You don't need a master's in English literature to pray. You don't need a PhD in theology to pray. It's about love, not cleverness. It comes from the heart, not from the head. Just as a mother will brave the school gates and the scary teacher to go and speak up for her son or daughter, so we go to God and speak up for our city. So it's about a focus on others. It's a focus on passion. And then it's about the balance of prayer and action. The end of prayer is not the end of the job. Once Abraham had finished his prayers, the angels set off on this highly dangerous rescue mission. There was no point, was there, in going to visit the city until the negotiation of prayer had been completed. But the prayer alone would not have rescued anybody. Prayer and action need to go hand in hand. And I don't know why, but I like this image of the coal mine. In a coal mine, you need pit props to secure the roof and keep the workers safe. Once the pit props are in place, you can go in and get the coal out more safely. Notice I didn't just say safely, more safely. If you don't have pit props, the roof will cave in, there'll be disaster, people will be hurt, and the coal will remain underground. But I want to say to you that trying it the other way round is no good either. Just going in and sticking the pit props in and not fetching the coal out, you've created a visitor's centre. We need the workers and the prayer. Sometimes we haven't got the strength or the opportunity or the freedom to go and do the work. We can pray. So, simple message really. This business of prayer is a crucial part of our Christian living. It's the prayer which is all about a focus on others, about bringing the passion of that love before God. And it's about following through with action. And the result? He asked for the city to be saved. He prayed that prayer. He negotiated wonderfully down from 50 to 45 to 40 to 30 to 20 to 10 and got to the point of concluding his prayer, at which point he's really in touch with the Spirit of God. He really knows what's going on. He's content with that situation. He knows what God will do. No. Even then, he was out by at least a factor of 50%, and the city became a pile of rubble for the archaeologists. And I want to say that prayer is rarely neat and tidy. Focused, passionate intercession challenges that image of the sort of slot machine God. Have you got prayers that have not been answered or not been answered the way you wanted? You haven't got an easy result? This is reality for us. Yes, of course, God answers prayer. Yes, of course, many of us have stories of wonderful answers to prayer. But this passage talks about a resolution that was not what the person who prayed expected. And I want to say that sometimes I hear stuff that sounds as though there's a neat and tidy theology, somehow explaining how God is loving and all-powerful, and yet there are disasters and tragedies. And I want to say that part of me, in the face of that, is outraged. As if theology and the understanding of God is comfortable in the face of tragedy. As if theology is a painkiller or a sleeping tablet which helps us to rest easy while the rest of creation groans. If that's what faith is about, I want none of it. Christian intercession looks at the hurting world, grieves alongside the suffering people, and yet trusts in God. We face this mystery together. And it says in this chapter, surely the judge of all the earth will do right. It's a statement of raw faith. Do you really understand the cross? I want to say at many levels I do not. How can we find joy in the middle of suffering? Victory in the middle of defeat? Love in the middle of hate? The cross of Jesus is baffling and wonderful. The basis of all our prayers. Prayer puts us in touch with this heart of our faith. Despite all our apologetics and our learned textbooks, we cannot prove that God exists. Sitting in a room, talking to someone we can't see, is the height of foolishness, except for faith. It's the ultimate foolishness of the Christian. Raw faith. We simply believe
that God is there. We believe that he cares for us. We believe that prayer makes a difference. That's all.